This morning, it's Kevin Kasson versus St. Gobain Performance.
On behalf of the appellants, Jim Castor appearing, I'll be taking 7 minutes in my initial argument, splitting my time. On the same day, December 11, 2006, the company moved the time clocks, in their own words, to, quote, comply with wage and hour laws, according to an internal memo that they circulated in September. That same day, they fired Kevin Kasson. Throughout this proceeding, the company has contended that these two events were coincidental. Mr. Kasson, in the days and weeks before this, in accordance with the Code of Ethics and the company's internal problem resolution procedure, had complained repeatedly that the location of the time clocks was illegal because it forced employees to work off the clock, that if the company was brought to court, it would lose, and that he was considering starting a lawsuit himself. On December 6th, immediately before he was brought into his suspension hearing, Mr. Kasson was brought aside by his supervisor, Dennis Wolverton, who told him that if you lay down and tell the company what they want to hear, you'll be able to save your job. Instead, Mr. Kasson went into the suspension hearing and again repeated that the location of the time clocks was illegal, a legal problem for the company, even though the company has taken the position throughout these proceedings that Mr. Kasson made no such complaints. At appellant's separate appendix at page 80, the court will see a memo that confirms from the company's perspective that Mr. Kasson said precisely that in the suspension meeting. So instead of being saved in terms of his job, Mr. Kasson was fired on the 11th. The issue is whether the verbal complaint is any complaint under 215A. Obviously, and the court is aware of this, the statute 215A was drafted at a simpler time when statutes were drafted in broader language, and court of appeals opinions often went 3 or 4 pages in length in total. In any case, the court, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, the court said the Congress was aware of the practice of requiring employees to file grievances with the union or the employer before going to court, which is exactly what happened here. Mr. Kasson, under the Code of Ethics, was required to report illegal behavior to the company, and he did that. And the Code of Ethics or the problem resolution procedure does not require a writing. So Mr. Kasson was encouraged to make these reports of illegal behavior to his employer. And this statute is, according to the U.S. Supreme Court in Tennessee Coal and in the Mitchell case, is required to receive a broad interpretation. I will note that in this year, under Title VII, in the Crawford versus Metro case, the U.S. Supreme Court said again under Title VII that anti-retaliation provisions are deserving of a broad interpretation to protect against the circumstance that the U.S. Supreme Court warned of in the Mitchell case, where you make reporting a calculated risk. This court in the Saperstein case has held that employees are protected by 215A even if the employer is not covered by the FLSA. In the Avidia case, an oral complaint to a labor investigator was a protected protected conduct under 215A. There's no difference between an oral complaint to the employer and an oral complaint to a labor investigator. Filed is filed. There's no reason to make a distinction between those two things. And the vast majority of cases have held that an internal report is a protected act under 215A.
Can we talk about the word filed for a minute?
Are
you going to address the question of whether a filing can be oral or written?
Well, I think that certainly, as I mentioned before, given the breadth of the statute and how it should be interpreted, filed is can be oral as well as written.
How do you file an oral complaint? How do you file a spoken word? You know, it seems to me that if the word file doesn't mean a writing, then you're writing the word filed out of the statute. It's superfluous because the Congress would just say complain rather than file complaint.
This court in 1975 in Faultless Division versus Local 240, 513 F. 2nd, 987, held that filed in the union grievance context can be an oral complaint. And so I think that that's a launching pad for an interpretation of filed that includes an oral complaint, Your Honor. The oral complaint has been interpreted by the vast majority of courts of appeals to include something that is lodged or filed can be to present for consideration. So I think that word filed can include an oral complaint, Your Honor. Is it related to the FLSA? With respect to the complaint that Mr. Kasten made, Mr. Kasten said the location of the time clocks was illegal. That's exactly what the company said in their internal documents, that the location of the time clocks made it a fact that employees would work off the clock because they donned and doffed before they went through the locker room and the clocks were after the locker room. And they did the reverse at the end of the day. With respect to, I'm going to wrap up here, I think, because I'm not sure if I'm going to get a light at 7 minutes. Very good. The facts justifying an inference of retaliation, as I said, Mr. Kasten is terminated on the same day that the company puts out its memo moving the time clocks. Mr. Kasten, the company put in its memo moving the time clocks that so many people were missing punches that they had to move the time clocks. So why was Mr. Kasten then picked out for retaliation and termination, if that's true? As I said before, his supervisor told him, you just tell them what they want to hear and your job will be saved. Instead, Mr. Kasten told them again that the location of the time clocks was illegal. The company has changed the policies that they have applied throughout this proceeding. At the Department of Labor in Wisconsin, they talked about the attendance policy. Very good. I will wrap up then on my rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Reeser.
Thank you. Excuse me. Sorry. May it please the court. The district court was incorrect in concluding that an employee's complaint to its employer about FLSA violations must be in writing before it triggers protection under Section 15A3 of the Fair Labor Standards Act. To the contrary, Section 15A3 should be broadly construed to protect employees who file oral complaints with their employer alleging violations of the FLSA. The Secretary of Labor administers and enforces the FLSA, and the anti-retaliation provision is central to achieving compliance with the Act. The language of 15A3 protects an employee who files any complaint or who institutes or causes to be instituted any proceeding or who testifies in any such proceeding.
Mr. Roger, would you be filing the complaint if you asked a coworker to make the complaint for you orally? You're not feeling well that day, you call that employee, their fellow worker. Would that constitute filing a complaint?
We would say no, that the employee would have to complain or communicate the complaint to the employer. And to communicate the complaint would mean to communicate the substance of his allegations that the Fair Labor Standards Act was being violated in some way.
What if the co-worker was his supervisor or her supervisor? Under my hypothetical of not being able to get there that day and call before work and ask the supervisor both receive and report the...
If the employee complained to his supervisor that the employer was violating the Fair Labor Standards Act in a telephone call, yes, we would say that would be protected. Mm-hmm. We think the secretary has consistently concluded that oral complaints are protected and has... engaged in enforcement actions on behalf of employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And in addition, under other whistleblower acts that the Secretary administers, The Secretary has also held that oral complaints to an employer are protected.
As a policy matter, though, in a world of proof, and all these cases eventually have to be determined if there's a legitimate grievance, would you say policy would indicate that we'd be in a better position in litigation if we had something in writing?
We know, not necessarily, because this Section 15A3 makes a distinction between instituting or causing to be instituted any proceeding and testimony under those that under that clause. And in the Memphis barbecue case in the Fourth Circuit, the court there noted that this indicated a more formal court or agency proceeding rather than a complaint to an employer. There have been 8 courts of appeals which have held that internal complaints to employers are protected under the FLSA. And of those, three appellate courts have held that oral complaints, strictly oral complaints, are protected when an employee is fired after complaining about unequal pay to an employer or about not being paid overtime. That employee should be protected. And 3 courts have so held. The Ninth Circuit in Lambert v. Ackerley looked at a case where an employee was fired after she complained orally as well as in writing, and in addition called the Department of Labor and hired an attorney. In that case, the Ninth Circuit said this is definitely a complaint. This person has filed a complaint, but there are other less detailed communications that would also be protected, and favorably alluded to circuit courts which have held that employees who complain orally or in writing about violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act are protected.
You would argue those are better reasoned than the second and the fourth.
We would argue that, but we think that the Fourth Circuit case doesn't really address file any complaint. It really looks more at testifying in a proceeding. And in fact, in that case, the court noted in a footnote that it had said file any complaint under the Federal Railway Act would be protected, an intracorporate complaint would be protected.
Could I ask you one quick question?
Yes.
Can you point to any evidence in the record that shows the plaintiff made an official complaint to his employer? In other words, it was more than just abstract grumblings?
We think that we're not taking a position on the facts here, but we do think that any allegation of a violation that would involve a non-payment of back wages or non-payment of wages, non-payment of overtime, would be sufficient to state a complaint.
Well, what if you just complained to the guy who was standing next to you on the line?
Well, it would have to be a complaint communicated to the employer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Godar.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I am Thomas Godar, and I represent the defendant appellee, Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics, in this matter. What is clear is that Mr. Kasten was terminated under a policy that demanded employees clock in and clock out each time they come and leave work. Indeed, Mr. Kasten has failed several times in just 9 short, 10 short, 11 months in clocking in and clocking out. February, again in August, later in November, he was suspended for the same behavior, and finally in December, he was terminated for this behavior. That was consistent with the 4-step disciplinary process that Saint-Gobain provided to Mr. Kasten and the other employees, and he was treated consistently under that standard. The question then is not whether he was terminated, there was an adverse action, but whether he meets the burden of proving under either direct or indirect evidence that he had engaged in protected, statutorily protected conduct. Before I turn to the question of whether he filed a complaint at all to engage that statutorily protected conduct, It's our position that either under the direct or the indirect proof of retaliation, Mr. Kasten fails, and you can provide summary judgment and affirm the decision below. Under the direct standard, Mr. Kasten must show that his alleged complaints were a substantial or motivating factor in the employer's decision, according to Gates versus Caterpillar. Mr. Kasten has offered virtually no causal connection between his alleged complaints and his termination, as was his responsibility under that case or under the recently decided Adda Dasami case or under the Sylvester decision. The appellant offers no evidence that the careful four-step procedure engaged in by Saint-Gobain was anything other than a garden variety action established under a progressive disciplinary process. Mr. Kasten suggests that on timing alone, this court should infer direct causation and a causal relationship. But, of course, in the Brown case, the court has found that timing alone is generally insufficient to establish a genuine issue of material fact. The same was true in the recent Hewlett-Packard case. And in the Tomanovich case, found that suspicious timing alone is rarely sufficient to create a triable issue. And on that, summary judgment should not be granted when there's mere temporal proximity, according to Weininger case. Here, we talk about the termination and the alleged complaints, and there is a dispute as to whether or not complaints were made. There certainly is a dispute as to whether or not complaints were made before the suspension. We believe they were not, and the record is undisputed there. The question then is whether or not the fact that he engaged in behavior that gives rise to termination and that at the same time he engaged allegedly in behavior that was a complaint is enough to establish a causal connection. With the uncontested evidence of the four-step disciplinary procedure, we submit that it is not. Likewise, the installation of time clocks on the same day, a large corporation like Saint-Gobain, as the record reflects, takes sometimes a very long time to make a decision. In this case, it was many months that they had contemplated moving the time clocks. It's not made simultaneously because one employee hypothetically or allegedly raised some sort of complaint under the FLSA. Likewise, under the indirect evidence standard, Mr. Kasten simply cannot withstand our motion for summary judgment. An affirmation is called for. Here, not only must he show that there was retaliatory activity under some sort of standard, which we'll talk about next, but also that he was treated less favorably than similarly situated employees who did not engage in statutorily protected activity. Mr. Kasten admitted that his coworker, who worked side-by-side with him, Art Bradison, was terminated along the same four-step process for failing to punch in and punch out before Mr. Kasten. Indeed, this policy created, unfortunately, about 10 terminations. The policy created terminations because of the consistent application of the progressive disciplinary standards. Others whose names include Poole, Schultz, Weatherall, and the other employees are cited in the record. Mr. Kasten suggested there might have been two employees who were treated differently, a Mr. McCure, who in fact was terminated within 1 month of Mr. Kasten for the same reason, and a Ms. Montefiore, who never substantially met all four of those steps. She was at the third step and rehabilitated her behavior before the policy changed. So under those standards, Mr. Kasten's complaint should be dismissed, according to summary judgment. But let's now turn for a moment to the question as to whether or not Mr. Kasten even engaged in statutorily protected conduct under the Fair Labor Standards Act. We submit that he did not. Protected activity under the FLSA was defined 70 years ago plus as follows. It shall be unlawful for any person to discharge or in any manner discriminate against any employee because such employee has filed a complaint, instituted or caused to be instituted any proceeding under or related to this chapter, or has testified or is about to testify in such proceeding, or has served or is about to serve on a industry committee. Those are four formal activities under which someone might then be protected in the anti-retaliation statute. If this court were to apply the plain meaning, as it suggests it ought in the Saperstein case, absent clearly expressed legislative intent to the contrary, that's where we begin, and, Your Honors, that's where we end. Kasten does not allege he instituted a proceeding. He says he filed the complaint. But filing in the complaint in the context of these other formal activities, like instituting a proceeding, has a specific meaning. In Genesee Hospital, it was put this way. The plain language of Section 215A3 limits the cause of action to retaliation for filing formal complaints, instituting a proceeding or testifying, but does not encompass complaints made to supervisors.
If you contend the word complaint only applies to those filed in, with courts or executive authorities, then how do you account for the word any? I mean, when I was talking to the addressing the appellant, I was suggesting that they were reading out the word filed. I'm suggesting to you that maybe you're reading out the word any.
I believe that the Congress understood that the use of the word any complaint, as it talked about instituted any proceeding, was broad enough but wasn't going to go beyond filing a lawsuit. That same Congress in 1938 created the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, where it talked about filing a complaint. It understood that filing and complaint work together, whether the word is a or any, had the same impact. It was a formal statement of intent. And in fact, what we're talking about is importing an oppositional standard as opposed to a participation standard into the Fair Labor Standards Act, which the Congress never intended. The oppositional language is found, for instance, in Title VII, opposes any action. That standard was used in the Crawford case, the Supreme Court case decided last month, to allow for the filing of an oral complaint. But the EEOC has quite different language in order to make that kind of activity, that is an oral concern raised to the employer, a retaliatory activity. Under the Title VII, an employee can make a charge, testify, or participate in any other under investigation. That is the participation standard. Otherwise, it's opposing any activity. Congress, 70 years ago, didn't put that in. It didn't put that opposition standard in. And in fact, the DOL has never adopted that standard. The EEOC and its enforcement manual has the opposition standard as an important feature. The DOL has never adopted such an oppositional standard in any writing. In fact, they have posters. I'm sure we'd find one in this courthouse. We'd find one in every place of employment, including Saint-Gobain, that says, if you have a problem under the Fair Labor Standards Act, call us. Institute a proceeding. Obviously, you can also file a complaint with the court. And it's those kinds of activities and not others that Congress understood. In 1985, the Supreme Court determined that the Fair Labor Standards Act applied to public sector employees. In that case, it applied a new statutory provision, which allowed basically an oppositional activity to be protected under the retaliation provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act. That lasted for 1 year. It sunset. Once that sunset, the Congress never applied that standard, Your Honors, to the private sector employees, and never continued that standard even to public sector employees after 1985. If, in fact, the court had wanted to apply that standard, it could do so through legislation. Recently, we saw Congress apply the Ledbetter Fair Play Act because the Congress wanted to change what the courts had understood its meaning to be under statute. That's what will have to happen here, we submit, in order for any sort of concern raised to an employer to suddenly become filing a complaint. The appellant reviewed a couple of cases. One was the Ackerley case. There they suggest we should adopt that standard, but even under Ackerley, even under Alero, amorphous expressions of discontent are not to be given the protection under the Act.
Isn't it true that the plaintiff did follow the grievance process outlined in the employee handbook?
No, Your Honor. First, to clarify, it's a dispute resolution procedure. It's not a grievance process. Second, it calls for some steps which over 6 months or 5 months, or I guess Mr. Kasten alleges that he first complained about this in September, over those 3.5-4 months, could have gone all the way through the steps to the regional manager of HR and then to the HR headquarters. Never did that. But more importantly, if we allow that to be the new standard for complaints of the Fair Labor Standards Act, essentially Congress, you're saying, delegated that authority to the employer. A lot of employers have no dispute resolution process or grievance procedure. Quite different than Saint-Gobain, but even here, Mr. Kasten didn't engage in that process. The district court found that his concerns were much more akin to amorphous expressions of discontent. There's a line drawn, and even his statements didn't seem to follow any sort of process. They were willy-nilly. They were here and there. If the court now finds that to be the formal action of filing a complaint, as that language was used by Congress, it would disregard, I submit, the very careful words it chose and the careful choice it made then and in 1985 and to today not to include an oppositional standard under the Fair Labor Standards Act. There's also been a request that there be deference to the Department of Labor. And while the Department of Labor is owed deference in certain circumstances, not here. The plain language doesn't support that. They're here in a litigation posture, and deference should not be granted in a litigation posture. They've never adopted any rules like the EEOC has, suggesting that there's an oppositional standard here. And, in fact, it is the Department of Labor that instructs employees to go and call the Department of Labor. Your Honors, in Saperstein, you found that there was a report to the Department of Labor, and either that was a filing a complaint or an amorphous or a institution of a proceeding. The court now has the opportunity to clarify that when you go before a Department of Labor, that is instituting a proceeding. That's precisely what that language was intended to mean 70 years ago, and it still means it today in its plain legal sense. But filing a complaint given that same plain legal sense should be filing a complaint before the court. Of course, the court needn't draw that line today. Today, the court can merely find, as it was argued before the district court but never gotten to by the district court, that the plaintiff, appellant, never satisfied his burden of proof. There's no direct or indirect evidence. The fact is he was terminated when he failed to clock in and clock out, a pretty simple procedure, frankly, Your Honor. And when he failed to clock in and clock out, the steps of the progressive disciplinary process applied to him just as it applied to all of the other employees. He has not shown that the explanation is pretext, and the best he can do is raise some sort of an artificial timing argument. It's simply not enough. Mr. Kasten was terminated for the actions as found by the employer in the termination letter, and for that reason, as well as the fact that he never filed a complaint under the Fair Labor Standards Act, we believe that the district court's summary judgment decision should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
The district court's interpretation of filed any complaint actually goes beyond even a writing. The district court said that things have to be put in their proper place. So what if an email is sent but deleted? What if a letter is sent but is thrown in the circular file instead of in its proper place? According to the district court definition of filed, that would not be filed. That would be something that the employer discarded, not put in its proper place. The specific findings in this case that should, the facts in this case that should have justified these findings, Mr. Kasten made the complaint about location of the time clocks being illegal to Dennis Brown, the director of human resources, to Lanny Williams, a human resources generalist, to Dennis Wolverton, his supervisor, to April Luther, the lead, to Mary Riley, a supervisor. He made that complaint to anyone who would listen. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, in the suspension meeting, he's told by his supervisor right before the meeting, if you lay down and tell them what they want to hear, your job will be saved. Instead, he goes in, and as I said, at Appendix 80, it says that he complained again about the location of the time clocks. This is, in the modern-day work world, Your Honor, an official complaint. This is what Mr. Kasten is really being called upon to do in the modern-day work world. I mean, he is making a complaint in accordance with a given policy that the employer has written down telling you that you can make these complaints informally. And he does that in accordance with their hotline, in accordance with their code of ethics, in accordance with their problem resolution procedure. He does exactly what the employer tells him to do. And in fact, in the Romeo case from the Sixth Circuit, and that's an equal pay case, but it is under the same provision that we're talking about here, the employee told her supervisor, you are breaking some sort of law here, with respect to the equal pay. That was enough of a complaint to justify protection under the Act. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Crawford case said these anti-retaliation provisions must be given broad application in order to protect employees in the workplace. Otherwise, what you have is the exact circumstance.
Your time is up.
I can just finish up, Your Honor. A perverse incentive for quick retaliation as soon as the employee opens his or her mouth would be the ultimate conclusion of a finding against the appellants here, and it's inconsistent with the broad remedial reading that must be given to 15A. Ironically, Your Honor, if I can...
I'm finished.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to